We want to thank Golda Hudis for sponsoring this evening's shir in memory of the observance of the Yortzei for her mother on the 13th of Tevet. That is tomorrow evening. Sara Bat Yaakov Vesimcha. So we want to thank Golda and should have good memories, long life, and the Shema should have an aliyah, and we should all have happy occasions to join together. Okay, Dr. Sokolo, let's get back to canonization and Tanakh, and you know, we can talk about language later.
Okay. You got to give me the screen.
Oh, I didn't do that. I'm sorry. Yes, yes, yes. Okay, it's coming right now.
We were preoccupied.
Yeah, we're preoccupied. That's it. There you go. You got it? Yeah.
I got it. Okay. So, this is our third foray into matters Masoretic. Reminding everybody again that the word Masoretic is an anglicization of the Hebrew word Masoret or Masorah, meaning a tradition, something that's handed down. And it refers to the physical distribution of words into sentences, sentences into paragraphs, paragraphs into chapters, etc. So we already looked at the divisions of the text into words, and we looked at the alphabet and its evolution from the ancient so-called Paleo Hebrew alphabet, which was a variation on the theme of the Phoenician alphabet, the very first one to ever exist. We looked into the division of the text into verses, and we began last week to take a look at the division of verses into parashiyot, and that's where we will pick up. So just again to remind you, this is the fact that the letters aren't clear is irrelevant to the subject of parashiyot. Every time there's a break in the text, that's a sign that one parasha has ended and another parasha has begun. And if you take a look carefully, there are two different kinds of gaps or breaks in the text. In the right-hand column, the paragraph at the very top of the text, the last line ends, and then there is a space, and the next parasha begins on the following line. That means that the parasha that begins after the space begins after an opening, after an open space, and therefore it's designated a parasha petucha. Then if we continue with that parasha down to the end of that paragraph, you see that that paragraph ends again towards the beginning of the line, and then there is a space, and then the following parasha begins on the same line. That means that it is closed, and that's why that parasha is designated as a parasha situma, a closed parasha. So there are two kinds of parashiyot, two kinds of, let's call them paragraphs. Some are open and some are closed. And then we said that the word parasha is sometimes misleading because we tend to refer to the weekly Torah reading as a parasha. Everybody very glib, including myself, will very glibly refer to parashat ha-shavua, right? But the truth of the matter is that most weekly Torah readings consist of more than one parasha. That is to say, more than one paragraph of text, as we just saw, as those paragraphs are either open or closed. And therefore, correctly, the proper designation, a more proper designation for a weekly Torah reading is a seder, or the feminine form sidra. So, except that, as I said, the term parashat ha-shavua has become so ingrained that it's just one of those things that's never going to change. So we left with this slide in which I pointed out that if you counted up the total number of parashiyot, when we're using the word parashat to designate a weekly Torah reading, that if you thought about it and you thought about the calendar, you might spot a discrepancy. So let's begin with that. There are in the book of Bereshit 12 weekly Torah readings, 11 in Shemot, 10 in Vayikra, 10 in Bimidbar, and 10 in Devarim. I totaled them up on the bottom of each column. So if we added 12 and 11 is 23, and 10 is 33, and 10 is 43, and 11 is 54. So there are 54 weekly Torah readings, weekly Sidarim, Sidrot, whatever the term that you choose to use. However, your average year has 52 weeks. So why would there be 54 parashiyot hashavua if there are only 52 weeks? Now, the answer is that, of course, the annual Torah cycle was designed for a Jewish year. And a Jewish year differs from an ordinary year, in that an ordinary year, which is a solar year, has 52 weeks because it has 364 days and change. Okay. But a lunar year has 11 fewer days. A solar year is 365 days and change. A lunar year is 354 days. So arguably, a lunar year might have as few as 50 weeks. Well, wait a second. So that would mean that if the annual Torah cycle had been designed for a Jewish calendar, there should be even fewer weekly Torah portions. So once again, how come there are 54? The answer is that every so often, seven times in a 19-year cycle, the Jewish calendar is supplemented or augmented by an extra month. So if you have a lunar calendar that is ordinarily 354 days long, approximately just 50 weeks, but you add a full extra month to it, so that's what brings the number of weekly Torah portions up to 54. There is, however, a problem, and that is that it isn't always 54. Apparently, on certain permutations of the calendar, would produce a different number, a smaller number. And that seems to be reflected in some of these sources. There is a long-standing difference of opinion amongst scholars as to exactly when the Zohar was written. But even if it was only written in the 13th century in Spain by Rabbi Moshe de Leon, it's still a reasonably venerable text. And if you see the highlighted portion in the Tikkuni Zohar, it talks about Gimel Nun Sidarim. You notice that it uses the word Seder or Sidra to designate a weekly Torah reading. And it talks about Gimel Nun Sidarim 53. And it even has a scriptural basis for it in a fragment of a verse from Shir HaShirim, Gan Na'ul Achoti Chala. Gan, Gimel Nun, right? Gimel is 3, Nun is 50. Okay. And this is reflected in several other medieval sources. Pitron Torah is an anonymous commentary on the Torah that was written sometime during the Gaonic era, perhaps in the 11th century, perhaps a bit later. And it says as follows, Yesh bekriyat shma nun gimel vavin b'rosh hateva, that the parashiyot, the combined three parashiyot of Shema, have 53 words that begin with the letter Vav. And he says, gives you some examples. Ve'ahavta, right? Uvechol, right? Etc. Vishinamta, okay? Why 53? Vechulhon, kineged, these are equivalent to Nun Gimel Parashiyot Shekorin Bechol Shana. There are 53 words in Shema that begin with a Vav, equal to the 53 parashiyot, 53 weekly Torah portions. doesn't really explain the reasoning here. The reason that he gives is that word vav the way the Torah is written is that not always, but in, I guess, 98 or maybe even 99% of Torah scrolls, the first word on the first line of each column begins with the letter Vav. And since a column is called an Amud, those letters, the Vavs that begin every column, are called Vavei HaAmudim, the Vavs of the columns, which is a term that's borrowed from the construction of the Mishkan. So the idea that you look for Vavs and you associate Vavs with Torah scrolls is not something that this commentary came up with on its own, but he's just simply making the association. And the same association, that is to say, to 53 weekly Torah readings, is made in one of the classics of the High Middle Ages, the commentary on prayer or on the Siddur by the Rokeach. The Rokeach was one of the early leaders of a movement in Ashkenaz in the late 12th and early 13th centuries, known as Hasidei Ashkenaz, the pietists or pious people of Germany. And they had a lot of their own rather particular traditions and customs. And this commentary on the Siddur by Rabbi Eliezer the Rokeach is reflective of many of these practices. Simply look to the fourth line, to the highlighted portion. He talks about the verse, Torat Hashem tmima mishivat nafesh edut Hashem ne'emana machimat peti pikudei Hashem yisharim misam chelev edut Hashem bara mirat einayim, a collection of verses from Psalms that are part of the Psukei Dezimra of Shabbat. And he says that if you take all of these verses, add up to the words, L'chol hachosim bo, right, the God is a pillar of strength to all those who place their trust in him. He says you'll see that they total Nun Gimel Tevot, 53 words. Why 53? Neged Nun Gimel Parashiot. And again, the idea that there are 53 weekly Torah readings, not 54. Same again in another portion of that same commentary on the Siddur. He observes that there are Nun Gimel Tevot Yesh B'Yishtabach, right, in the concluding prayer of Psukei DeZimra. There are 53 words. Once again, Keminyan Nun Gimel Parashiyot, again, equivalent to the 53 weekly Torah readings. Similarly here, we have a book which is subtitled Perush L'Chamisha Chumshei Torah, a commentary on the Torah, Mei Rabbeinu Aharon Rabbi Yossi HaKohen, that's the author, Mibalei HaTosafot, right? One of the leading Jewish scholars of France and Germany during the late 12th, early 13th centuries, wrote a commentary on the Torah, and it's called Sefer HaGan. And why is it called Sefer HaGan? Again, because at least where he was living in France during this period of time, the Torah reading, the annual Torah reading, consisted of 53 portions rather than 54, which would seem to suggest that two of our current portions were apparently combined into one, and there is no unanimity of opinion among scholars, or I should be more correct and say amongst those few scholars who are interested in this subject, no unanimity amongst them as to exactly which portions that are otherwise considered to be separate may have been joined together in this tradition of 53. We also pointed out that while the annual Torah cycle is pretty much universal these days, the only exceptions I know of are some Reform congregations that for some reason have decided to go back to the triennial cycle, but that at least through the High Middle Ages, the custom of reading the Torah annually was prevalent in Babylonia, and throughout the Jewish world that followed the precedents of the Babylonian academies. However, at that same time, in the land of Israel, and throughout the Jewish world in those communities that followed the precedents of the academies of the land of Israel, the Torah reading was still completed only every 3 years, known as the triennial Torah cycle. And here just simply to tell us how they counted their weekly Torah portions. Obviously, if they completed a cycle in 3 years, they should have approximately three times as many portions. So the only question is, would they be multiplying 50 by 3, 52 by 3, 53 by 3, or 54 by 3? So it turns out that, as you see here, Rov ha-mikorot ha-mitzuyim bi-adenu, the majority of sources that we have today, most of which come from the Cairo Geniza, matzbiyem al chalukat ha-Torah, they indicate a division of the Torah, lekuf nun dalet sidarim, 154 weekly portions. Mispar sidarim zeh, this number of portions, muvah b'sofam, shulchum ha-shem ha-mupasim bi-ameinu, lefi ha-perot haba, and they are distributed as follows amongst the five books of the Torah. Breshit was 43, Shemot 29, Vayikra 23, Bimidbar 32, and Devarim 27. The reason that it's not three times 54 or even three times 53 is because the 53 and the 54, as we said, were meant to accommodate a leap year. Okay? In a three-year cycle, you cannot have three consecutive leap years. Okay? In fact, during the 19-year cycle of the Jewish calendar, most of the time you have to wait 3 years for a leap year to come into play, not even 2 years. So I guess what they figured out is that in your average 3-year cycle, there would only be one leap year. So they only needed to accommodate that. Now, for those of you who have a Tanakh printed by the Koren Publishing Company, you can actually keep track of the triennial cycle. I apologize for the fact that for some reason the text is a little not sharply in focus, but you should be able to tell all the same. I just simply chose last week's Torah reading. Okay, so you can see in the right-hand column the word Vayigash. Right, that's simply indicating that that's this week's or last week's weekly Torah portion. If you look at the inside margins of the page, you can see that the verses are lettered consecutively, right? Not numbered, they're lettered consecutively according to the alphanumeric value of the Hebrew alphabet, okay? So that, and the very top of the page on the inside column, you see the letters Mem Dalet. Okay, that tells you that this is the 44th numerical chapter of the book of Genesis, and that the weekly Torah portion of Vayigash begins in chapter 44, verse 18. Okay, so if you take a look at the left-hand side of the page in the right-hand margin, you see that three lines down, chapter 44 ends, and you see the letters Mem He, chapter 45 begins. Okay? But if you look in the right hand, on the right hand page, in the right hand column, right after the word Vayigash, you see the Hebrew letter Mem. That is because the Koren Tanakh maintains not just the what has become the customary division of the text into numerical chapters, but it also keeps track of the sequence of parashiyot, of paragraphs. Therefore, the Sidra Vayigash that begins only in numerical chapter 44 of Bereshit is actually the 40th parasha in Bereshit. So the Koren Tanakh provides one with the ability to keep track of where the where the Torah readings, weekly Torah readings, would be if we were following a triennial cycle. And as long as we've drawn attention to the numerical chapters, the division of Tanakh into numerical chapters is not Jewish in origin, and it isn't even ancient. It originates in the Vulgate, the official Latin version of the Torah. It was introduced in the 13th century by an Anglican bishop, and his purpose was to make it easier for Christians to find certain verses in the Jewish Bible in order to be able to quote them at Jews when they were debating them. They used the word debates, but these weren't so much debates as they were actually disputations. Okay. Since the earliest printers of the Bible were Christians, right? Daniel Bamberg, a very famous printer of the early 16th century of Bibles, even produced one that we call the Rabbinic Bible, the Mikraot Gedolot, was a Christian. Okay. Since the earliest printers of the Bible were Christians, they followed this division of the text into numerical chapters, beginning, as you see, with Daniel Bamberg's Mikraot Gedolot, the 1516-17 Venice edition, and as well the earliest concordance of the Bible, which was similarly produced in the 13th century, was prepared according to those divisions. Meaning if you wanted to locate a particular word, you had to be able to find it according to its chapter and verse. Okay. Jews apparently did not need the text to be divided into numerical chapters because they already had, for at least a millennium, the traditional division into parashiyot. So instead of saying, where does the Torah reading of Vayigash appear? You didn't have to say numerical chapter 44, verse 18. You could say it was parasha 40 in Sefer Bereishit. While this division into numerical chapters, as I said, becomes standard, even in most traditional Jewish editions, even Art Scroll, right? One should take note of the fact that at times it is rather deliberately Christian. For example, okay, the very first numerical chapter in the Torah, Genesis chapter 1, concludes at the end of the sixth day of creation, deliberately separating Shabbat from the rest of the week. Okay. Other incongruous divisions, they're noted here. They're not of any tremendous import. If you add up all of the numerical chapters in every one of the 24 constituent books of Tanakh, you will discover that the number is 929. Ah, so you've heard of 929. Well, actually, the reason that I'm here with you this evening originates with 929. So I thought we'd just take a moment and join me and just, we'll take a minute and we'll just try to, hopefully, well, do I have to come out of the, I think, no, it's not working. I think I have to come out of the full screen in order to get you into that text, if in fact it opened. No, it didn't open. All right, so you'll just have to suffer through my explanation rather than watching a professionally made video. No, here we go. Okay.
Hey guys, welcome to Forward. We're a new type of doctor's office that's providing preventative primary care. We've got
929. Have you ever considered the significance of this number? It's formed a rhythm to life with the power to connect someone from 1,000 years ago with someone from today. 929 is the number of chapters in Tanakh, the Hebrew Bible, chapters that people have been reading. Sometimes one at a time, sometimes as a collective, for thousands of years. And now, that age-old rhythm can be experienced in an entirely new way. 929 is a website launched in July 2018. that you can access via URL or app. Whereas people used to discuss ideas in an agora, forum, or marketplace, in the new millennium, public discourse happens on platforms. 929 is a platform with a purpose. It's a new way to read, talk, listen, and write about the Bible, and it's in English. When you visit the website, you'll be brought into the daily chapter as part of a cycle of learning taking place worldwide. You can read the primary text, listen to a recording of it, or view a wide range of thoughts, commentaries, and interpretations of the daily chapter. Sunday through Thursday, a different chapter is studied, with Friday and Saturday devoted to review. Through 929's platform, you can read and hear the voices of artists, scholars and students, novelists, archaeologists, and public figures. You too can contribute by learning and submitting your thoughts and ideas on a given text. The space is one that is democratized and creative and ever-growing. You can go back and access content from previous chapters in the journey through the calendar in the banner's drop-down menu. Sync your calendar and learn along. Visit particular days, books, and chapters of interest. If you find a writer you like, all their pieces are available on their page. And when chapter 929 is reached, the cycle begins again. Join us as we mark each milestone on a journey through time and Tanakh. The Bible was written a long time ago, but it lasts forever. Learn with us and make it your own.
There we go. Okay. Just give me a moment and I will get us back to where we were. Okay. So, that was the commercial for 929. So we've completed the discussion about the division of text into words, into sentences, into paragraphs, into chapters. So we move now into one other aspect or dimension of the physical text of Tanakh. That is its vocalization and its punctuation. Again, vocalization means assigning vowel qualities to what otherwise are consonants. The Hebrew alphabet, whether we're talking about the 22 basic letters or the 26 letters, 27 letters, if we add the final forms, right, are all consonants. Therefore, in order to read a Hebrew text, it has to be accompanied by vowels. And the act of assigning vowel qualities to the consonantal text is called vocalization. Okay. So what we have here is a text from the Talmud, Masechet Megillah, which says as follows. It starts with a verse in the book of Nehemiah. It's easy to remember because it's chapter 8, verse 8. Okay. The verse reads as follows. Vayikru'u ba'sefer, they read aloud in the book. Which book? B'sefer Torah Ta'elohim, the book of the Torah, the instruction of God. Miforash, clearly. V'som seichel, intelligibly. Vayavinu ba'mikra, and they understood what they were reading. Okay? So what the Talmud does, and this is rather typical, is that it takes every word or every phrase in the verse and it interprets it as part of the process of developing the text. So it says as follows. The opening phrase, Vayikru'u b'sefer Torah Ta'elohim, that they read aloud from the text of the Torah, right? From the divine text. It says, Ze Mikra. You can see the matching highlight in the English translation. That's Mikra. That's the consonantal text itself. Miforash, Ze Targum. That is the Aramaic translation or version of the Torah. Okay. I've devoted a specific slide to this, but in the time of the Talmud, and not only in the time of the Talmud, but largely in the Talmudic period and in the near Talmudic era, that is to say, up to probably about, I don't know, the 11th or 12th century, more often than not, the public Torah reading consisted not only of the Hebrew text, but it consisted of the reading of the Hebrew text along with the public reading of the Aramaic Targum of the Torah. That custom somehow died out at some point in the Middle Ages, almost everywhere in the world, with the exception of Yemen. Some places in Persia as well, but largely in Yemen. In Yemen, I would say to this very day, if there were still a minyan operating in Yemen and they were still reading the Torah there, but that's no longer the case. But to this very day, Jews who follow strictly the traditions of Yemenite Jewry, still, when they read the Torah on Shabbat, the reader will pause at the end of every Hebrew verse and wait until somebody else reads aloud the Aramaic Targum of that verse. By the way, that's not the only way in which Yemenite Torah reading differs from the Torah reading that most of us are acquainted with. Another difference is that in the Yemenite tradition, the person who is called to the Torah is expected to read his own text. Right? Whereas the tradition that we're most familiar with assigns that to a professional Torah reader. Okay, so again, the point is that if the verse in Nehemiah is interpreted to delineate the consonantal text, the Mikra, its translation into Aramaic, the Targum, the Psukim, right? Its division into verses, that is to say, its punctuation, okay? Some say even the Masoret, right? Even the tradition of reading it, maybe the tradition of what melodies to assign to the different notes. Essentially, what the Talmud is trying to say is that it is their belief that as early as the 5th century BCE, right, would be the time of Ezra and Nehemiah, there was already a standard way in which the Torah would be read, at least in public, and that there was an agreed upon text, consonantal text. There was an agreed upon way in which the consonants were to be vocalized. There was an agreed upon division into verses, and an agreed upon melody that accompanied its public readings. The truth of the matter is that by the time we have enough information about things, we find that there are no fewer than 3 different vowel systems that seem to have competed with each other during the early Middle Ages. We know of a system that originated in Babylonia, in which the vowel symbols, which are very different from our own, were placed above the letters in the text rather than largely below them. And that's why scholars refer to this as supralinear, above the line. And there were 2 systems that originated in the land of Israel, both of which placed their own different symbols below the consonantal text, and therefore the technical name by which they are known is sublinear. Of these 2 systems that originated in the land of Israel, one of these systems that originated amongst the Masoretes, that is, those who were concerned with the tradition of proper reading and punctuation, right, lived in the city of Tiberias. And it was their system, the Tiberian system, that eventually entered into universal use amongst Jews, first in manuscripts and later in printed editions. So the vowels that we are acquainted with, that we learned either in kindergarten or that we learned in cheder or whatever it is that we learned them, right? Some short vowels, some longer vowels. These all originated in Tiberias, somewhere during the High Middle Ages. That is to say, during the 10th, 11th centuries. So much so that we have here a 12th century text, the Machzor, which is a collection of prayers not only for the weekdays, but for Shabbat and for the holidays, that was edited by a Rabbi Simcha of the town of Vitry in France, who was himself a student of Rashi. And in his Machzor, he writes as follows. B'shesha altem, somebody wrote him a question asking, Im asur linkod sefer Torah, whether it is prohibited to put any kinds of symbols into a Torah scroll. And his answer is as follows. Sefer Torah shenitan l'Moshe b'Sinai. To the best of our knowledge, he writes in the 13th century, the Torah that was dictated by God to Moses at Mount Sinai, or that Moses wrote either at Sinai or during the 40 years in the wilderness, lo shama'anu bo nikud. He says, our tradition is that there were no marks in it, meaning only all it had in it were the consonants. There were no symbols, no marks, no nikud marking the vowels and none that mark the punctuation. Volonitan nikud b'sinai. Furthermore, he says that the vowel marks, the signs, were not revealed at Mount Sinai. Ki hachachamim tzienuhu lisiman. Rather, he says, these vowel signs were introduced by the sages. He doesn't say which sages. He doesn't say whether he's talking about the sages of the Mishnah, the sages of the Talmud. He doesn't say, right? Nevertheless, he concludes, asur lanu lahosif mida'atenu. We ourselves are prohibited from adding any new kinds of symbols to the ones that they already introduced. Pen na'avor b'val tosif, lest we violate the prohibition of adding something to the Torah text. Therefore, he concludes once again, lefichach, therefore, ein nokedin sefer Torah. We do not place any marks in a Torah scroll, neither the vowel signs nor the punctuation marks. Nevertheless, he says, our tradition, which we believe to be the correct way to vocalize those words and to punctuate those sentences, he believes that the tradition that these signs represent is as ancient as the revelation of the law at Sinai. Okay. And he cites as his proof text the same verse from the book of Nehemiah that we saw in the previous slide from the Talmud. However, he says, al peh ne'emru. That is to say, that the fact that the first word in the Torah, spelled bet, resh, aleph, shin, yod, tav, is pronounced bereshit. He says, the tradition of its correct pronunciation goes back to Sinai. But the symbols that tell you that that is the way it is to be pronounced, the Shiva under the Bet, the Tseire under the Resh, the Chirik under the Shin, all these, he says, Lo b'simanei nikida b'sefer, all of these were only part of an oral tradition, and they did not accompany the Torah text at the beginning. Simply an historical observation, the Karaites, whose break from rabbinic Judaism dates somewhere to the 8th or 9th centuries, when they read the Torah in their synagogues, they do not use a scroll as we do. They use a book, a codex. And in their codex, the consonants are both vocalized and punctuated, right? Which probably makes it very easy to study to be a bar mitzvah boy in a Karaite synagogue, okay? And therefore, I'm just simply noting that it's possible that the Machzor Vitri's emphasis on the prohibition of putting vowel signs or punctuation marks into a Torah scroll may in fact be part of an anti-Karaite polemic. Now, if we have already taken note of the fact that at one point in time, there were no fewer than three different traditions of vocalization, and there were different systems of punctuation as well, how did we arrive eventually at a consensus? And the answer is that we have Maimonides to thank. Maimonides, in his Mishneh Torah, has a section in which he deals with things that are scribal. It's a combination of the laws of Tfilin, Mezuzah, and Sefer Torah. And towards the end, he writes as follows. Since I have seen that there are great errors in all the scrolls I've examined in this regard, and furthermore, he says, since the Masoretes, right, the Baalei Masorah, who were experts on this subject, right, disagree amongst themselves, what is Rambam write? He writes, Ra'iti, I have seen fit, lichtov hena, to record here in the Mishneh Torah, kol parashiyot ha-Torah, all of the Torah portions or paragraphs, stumot, those that are sealed, ptuchot, those that are open, surat ha-Shirot, the song at the sea, and the song of ha-Azinu, that are written, that have a different physical form in the text. Maimonides specified exactly how all of this is supposed to be written in a Torah scroll. Kedei l'taken aleihem kol ha-sefarim, so that all other scrolls will be brought into line with this. Ula hagia mehem, and so that we could produce a perfect scroll that others could use for proofreading. And the question arose right away, what was Maimonides following? Which tradition? So he tells us, he says that the book that he himself relied upon in these matters, that is the division into parashiyot and the way the songs in the Torah are to be constructed, he calls it HaSefer HaYadua B'Mitzrayim. It's a book that's well known throughout Egypt. Shukolel arba'a ve'esrim sefarim. Not a text of the Torah alone, but a text of the entire Tanakh, all 24 canonical books. Shehaya birushalayim mikama shanim, which previously was in the city of Jerusalem, where it served lahagia mimenu hasefarim, where scribes used it as a yardstick to measure their own work. That is to say, they used it as a text to which they would compare their own. Va'alav hayu hakol somechim. And this book was so authoritative that everybody relied upon it. What made it authoritative? Lefisha hagiho ben asher v'dikdek bo shanim harbeh. V'higiho pa'amim rabot, because it was examined minutely over many years and proofread many times by somebody called Ben Asher. And Maimonides concludes by writing, Allah, it was on this scroll, the one that was previously in Jerusalem and subsequently, but was still well known in Egypt, this scroll that was produced by this master Masoretic named Ben Asher, that is the scroll that Maimonides himself relied upon, B'Sefer HaTorah Shekatavti Kihilchato. When Maimonides himself sat down to write a proper Torah scroll, he followed the instructions of the Ben Asher text. Now, some scholars have argued that there never was an historical Ben Asher, Neither was there an historical Ben Naphtali who was said to have opposed Ben Asher in certain respects. They actually claim that these are typological names. Asher comes from the word me'ushar, meaning proper. Naphtali comes from the word naftol, which means crooked or awkward. So they maintained that all of the scrolls that were finally agreed upon and regarded as authoritative were called the Asher scrolls because they were considered appropriate. And everything else was called a naftol scroll. It was considered crooked or awkward. Okay. Other scholars have even gone so far as to hypothesize that many of these early Masoretes, including the Ben Ashers, were actually Karaites, because the Karaites were more preoccupied than rabbinic scholars with the text of the Bible, because they had nothing else to rely upon. They didn't accept the Talmud. Okay. Now, current scholarship posits that the book to which Maimonides was referring in Mishneh Torah is the book that we know today as the Aleppo Codex. It's called in Hebrew the Keter, the crown of Aram Tzova. Aram Tzova is the biblical name for the Syrian city of Aleppo. The Keter Aram Tzova, the Aleppo Codex, is a manuscript of the entire Tanakh, a codex, a book, not a scroll, right, in which the consonants are both vocalized and punctuated. What is it doing in Aleppo? It was brought to Egypt either during Maimonides' lifetime or shortly thereafter, probably at the time that the land of Israel was under siege by the Christian crusaders. So it was probably taken to Egypt for safekeeping. Several generations later, there were problems in Egypt. Probably the arrival of the Seljuks, and it was once again moved. In this case, apparently by a descendant of Maimonides, who moved himself and his family to the city of Aleppo in Syria, and apparently took the scroll along with him. So it has been in Aleppo since the 14th century, to the best of our knowledge. It was guarded zealously by the congregation there. Very few people over the course of 500 years were allowed to see it. And only a handful were allowed to copy portions of it. It was thought to have been destroyed during riots that took place in Aleppo in 1948. But it turns out that it was spared, or it was saved, and it resurfaced and has since been published in a facsimile edition, and a portion of it is on display in the Shrine of the Book at the Israel Museum alongside the Dead Sea Scrolls. I will show you in a moment a picture of a portion of the Aleppo Codex, but I want to prepare you for it. And I want to do it by hakarat hatov, by showing gratitude to the late scholar Moshe Goshen Gottstein, one of the leading authorities on the subject of Masorah at the Hebrew University, who made a singular contribution to the identification of the Aleppo Codex as the manuscript that Maimonides used. Why did it require the work of scholarship? Because of this. When Maimonides goes ahead and describes the way in which the Song at the Sea and the Song of Moses are supposed to be written in a Torah scroll, if you open up your standard Mishneh Torah, it says, and you can see the highlighted passage, Kotvin ota, that the Song of Ha'azinu should be written b'shiv'im shitot, on 70 lines. Okay? So, obviously then, the manuscript that Maimonides relied upon, the one that he said had been in Jerusalem and had been proofread by Ben Asher himself, dictates that the Song of Ha'azinu is written on 70 lines. Here you go, folks. Simply to save us all time and trouble, and because the text isn't always very clear, I put a little red mark after every 10th line. So all you really have to do is count up the packages of 10 and tell me how many lines is the Song of Ha'azinu written on in the Aleppo Codex. There you go. Really, I'll have to start from the last red line and count how many are over. And there are 7 lines past the last red mark, which means that in the Aleppo Codex, the Song of Ha'azinu was written on 67 lines. And that is why, until Professor Moshe Goshen Gottstein, some point in the last 50 years, not earlier than that, if you asked somebody, did Maimonides use the Aleppo Codex? They would tell you, well, I would like to think so. He gives every indication. But how do you reconcile the fact that Maimonides in the Mishneh Torah clearly says that the Song of Ha'azinu occupies 70 lines, while the text itself clearly has only 67. So you know what Professor Goshen Gottstein's genius was? His genius was that since you obviously can't change the number of lines in the Aleppo Codex, right? There's no way to say that the Aleppo Codex has anything other than 67 lines. If you really believe that Maimonides used the Aleppo Codex, then think about it logically. There is one very, very clear solution. The printed text of Maimonides' Mishneh Torah is inaccurate. And the passage that we read just a moment ago that says that the Song of Ha'azinu should be written on 70 lines is erroneous. And indeed, here we have a different edition of the Mishneh Torah of Maimonides. This is an edition that was prepared by the late Rabbi Kafach of the Yemenite community, in which you can see very clearly that according to this version of the Mishneh Torah, the Song of Ha'azinu was written on Sheva Vishishim Shitot. It is to be written not on 70 lines, but on only 67 lines. I'm going to end this evening with this text, and that is simply in recognition and in gratitude to Golda Yudes, and in memory of her mother, Sarah Bat Yaakov V'Simcha. This is a different codex. Like the Aleppo Codex, this too was once a codex, not just of the Torah, but of the entire 24 books of the Bible, of Tanakh. It's called the Lailashi Codex because it was kept in all places in the town of Lailashi, which is somewheres in western Georgia, which is where Dr. Yudes herself originated, so to speak, since we're talking about origins. So here you have, if this is much clearer and easier to read than the photo that I had of the Aleppo Codex, and you can see that this is not just the consonantal text. It's the consonantal text along with its proper vocalization and along with its proper punctuation and even a bit of artwork. So there we are. And with that, I will take a quick look at the chats. Oh, I don't know what's wrong with my, I can't figure out what's wrong with my screen.
Do you mean to read it to you?
My computer, for some reason, has squashed everything.
Okay,
so that I get only 4 letters to a line, and I can't read a whole text.
Okay, you know. Okay, you can try again. In other words, I'm happy to read the questions. Okay. Yeah, there's just some discussion on how conservative shuls today. Some of them read it. This Torah, even they don't do it. I don't know if any do a triennial sanctification, take it really every 3 years to divide it. But okay, that was just yes, as you said, they switch back. You were talking about reform shuls. Okay, fine. Let's see what else. How did the Simchas Torah play into the 2 off years? There wasn't Simchas Torah. right?
This, yeah, there's Simchas Torah only every 3 years.
Right. This I don't think they had
Toldos
it. This
Chag Simchas Torah, this Avram beautiful Yari. Book.
Here you go.
Avram this, Yari. You must have right. a later edition.
I don't have. I guess I have the old edition. And in the opening chapter, he discusses the shul in Cairo, where there were two shuls on the same street in Cairo. One did a triennial cycle and one did an annual cycle, but they would come together in Simchas Torah, like they got along. So that's how he opens up the book. So as late as the 10th century, I believe, you still had in Egypt, in Cairo. What do you want to add, doctor?
Yeah. Fortunately, the synagogue that housed the Cairo Geniza followed the Palestinian rite. That's why there's so much material in the Cairo Geniza that sheds light on these practices that were subsequently dropped.
Right. Okay. So, right. It's sort of, you know, I think people find that interesting that, you know, like all of the stories are made up holiday. It all develops in the Middle Ages, but they didn't have it in Israel. Okay. I've commented many times Simchas Torah is really a Chutz Laaretz holiday. And it's Shmini Atzeret and Chutz Simchas Torah. They don't work together well in Israel. Yisker and Hakafa, it's sort of whatever. But okay, that's for historical reasons. There is Simchas Torah developed only in Chutz Laaretz. Okay, Machzor Vitri, expression Lo Shemana Nikud implied Torah text that Moses received was not audible because it had no Nikud. I don't know.
Pardon? Didn't quite catch that.
Gershon, right. Are you saying, does it imply the Torah received was not audible? I'm not sure what you mean.
No. Shamanu is a technical term. It means to have a tradition.
Oh, okay. Lo shamanu. That's okay. Fine.
Lo shamanu means we have no tradition.
Yeah, but could it mean didn't have? Could it mean no?
No, not at all. It's a technical term. It means, sometimes you'll say lo ra'inu means there's no textual evidence. Lo shamanu means there isn't even any evidence of an oral tradition.
Okay, in the context of lack of nikud, it's an ambiguous expression that I'm wondering whether it's meant to have a double meaning, in spite of your skepticism.
Okay, he thinks not, but though you okay. Then Ivan wants to know if the three systems, I guess that's Ben Asher, Ben and Naphtali, have different pronunciations and which letters are vocalized.
I don't think we know because there's no living tradition of its pronunciation. Ostensibly, whether you placed a sign above a letter or below it should not have affected the way it was pronounced. At least the Machzor Vitri maintains that the pronunciation is part of a tradition that goes back to Sinai itself. But of the three, the Tiberian one is the only one that, you know, that continue. So maybe one day we'll not only find a new Geniza,
get a recording.
But there'll be a recording in it.
Yeah, when they have the alibi, that'll be some trick. Okay, Donna wants to know about the dots. I don't know if you want to answer that now. I assume that needs greater treatment. The dots on some of the letters in the Torah.
We'll get into that next week. Thank you.
That's okay. There you go. And Gershon's pointing out that Moshe Gun Gottstein was his brother-in-law. Cool. Okay. Okay. Who used the Aleppo Codex? Which Sofrim in which countries? So Sofer in Worms or London, writing a scroll in Germany or England, etc. Right?
As I said, the scroll was guarded zealously by the community in Aleppo that basically just did not allow access to it. There is an argument that somehow information about that scroll was obtained first in the 12th or 13th century in Spain by Rabbi Meir Abulafia, who wrote a manual for scribes reflecting that practice. And there's a separate tradition that says that information about the Aleppo Codex somehow made its way in the 16th century to Poland, and was used by Rabbi Moses Isserles, the Rama, in his treatment of scribal laws. So those are two traditions. I don't know that there is any way to verify them or, in fact, to contradict them historically, but they're traditions nonetheless.
Okay. Thank you very much. We'll look forward to next week. The thoughts on the letters. Yes, that's all kinds of interesting stuff. Tomorrow night, maybe we can have the shiur in French because Rabbi Bram Weinberg from Silver Spring, Maryland, who grew up in Montreal, will be giving the Parsha shiur. Is now Rabbi in Silver Spring, to go back full circle to the beginning of the shiur. And then that's tomorrow night at 8:30. And of course, my shiur Friday morning, 9 a.m. on the Siddur. We look forward to seeing you and your friends. Please invite them to join us, and everybody be well, and Laila Tov. Have a good night. Enjoy. It's supposed to be 15 degrees here in Toronto tomorrow, so that's pretty amazing. 15 degrees Celsius. That's about 60. So that's, wow, December the 16th. That's like unbelievable. Okay. Anyways, have a good night, everybody. Be well. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Thank you. Have a good night.
Thank you. Thank you.